Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, Roy Field here. Before we start, we have a new advertiser. Now, before some of you go, ugh, and fast forward a couple of minutes, please lend me your ears, because this is important, because it helps to keep the lights on around here and pay some bills. And this advertiser is also very different. Knowledge of the classics is back in style. You know, it's people like those philosopher authors, people like Homer and Cicero and Spinola, and some of the moderns like Nietzsche as well. Online Great Books is designed to help you to develop a regular habit of reading the great works of Western culture. With weekly reading goals, reading reminders, accountability tools, and a dedicated community of fellow readers, they can help you keep on track and on schedule with your reading. OnlineGreatBooks.com has a reading goal system that is designed to help you to progress through reading and the comprehension of the great books, with just 3 one-hour reading sessions each week. Every month, they select for you an edition of one of the great books, and they will send it directly to your home. They begin with Homer, and then progress through the works of Plato, Aristotle, Descartes, and then on to the moderns. They even do Shakespeare. So if you're interested in developing a lifelong habit of reading and studying the classics of Western culture, go to onlinegreatbooks.com/ROI. Enter the promo code ROI to get your 25% off your first 3 months of learning. Enjoy.
This podcast is a Roy Field Brown production. Find others on iTunes.
All right. Yeah, I know.
In an uncertain world, there is always music which can be listened to in good company. Welcome to Friday, the show where we speak to friends and interesting people to the backdrop of great tunes. Today we speak to Aziz Eldori of the History of Westeros podcast to ask just why is Game of Thrones so compelling. Aziz, why is it that this thing, Game of Thrones, has become arguably the most successful, most impactful cultural phenomena since The Sopranos?
I'm glad you mentioned The Sopranos specifically, because I remember about, I think it was 4 years ago, it was about around the time of Game of Thrones season 4, when it was announced that Game of Thrones had passed The Sopranos, which it had 6 seasons. So after only 4 seasons of Game of Thrones, it had passed The Sopranos as HBO's most popular show of all time. And of course, since then, it's only gotten bigger. I grew up with Star Wars, and Star Wars is still one of the largest fandoms, if not the largest fandom ever. And I think that a lot of us who grew up with that, it kind of set the stage for other fandoms to become just a bigger part of life, people's day-to-day life, and a way to make friends. And, you know, when I was in high school, you know, being interested in Star Wars and Dungeons and Dragons, and Game of Thrones didn't exist yet, but if it had, it would have been in that category, which is of just, it's pretty uncool. You know, those were like nerdy, geeky things. And nowadays, people still call them nerdy, geeky things, but that's now a plus or a badge of honor. It's no longer socially unacceptable. So I think that's a big part of it, is that fantasy and sci-fi are more mainstream now and more acceptable. I think a lot of the people who grew up with it, they're adults now, and they don't have the attitudes that their parents had when they were, you know, parents who didn't grow up with that sort of thing. So there's a different viewpoint on it. You know how each generation takes on a different form of entertainment. But sometimes these things take multiple generations to play out. And with Game of Thrones, I think it owes some debt of gratitude to Harry Potter, which I personally haven't read, but I'm very thankful that it exists because it introduced a lot of people to fantasy, young adults. Harry Potter was aimed at kids, but it was popular with people of all ages, but especially people who grew up with it. Sort of, I wouldn't say they graduated to Game of Thrones because it's not necessarily better. It's just different. And it was, but it is fair to say Game of Thrones was aimed for a more adult audience, considering some of the themes in it. And so I think that sort of paved the way. So I think this confluence of factors, you have fandoms and geek and nerd culture just being more mainstream. You have several iterations of this happening in past generations. And then you have a story that really breaks a lot of these molds and is just really well done. I think that's a big part of it. George R. R. Martin's an excellent author. Not all of his excellent writing has made it to the Game of Thrones TV show, but his vision, his world, his creations have. And it's the thing I think that really sets it apart from other fantasy is that the fantasy world isn't the focus at all. It's all about the characters. It's all about human stories. It's all about human psychology and believable characters. The setting is very unbelievable, but the way the characters react to this unbelievable setting is very realistic. George R. R. Martin is very good at that. He's very good at writing characters of lots of types. He writes women. I wouldn't say he's great at writing women, but he's better than most male authors at writing women. And he writes children pretty well, and that's really hard to do. So it appeals to a lot of people. And I think you can't just, I know I've gone on for a while on this question, but you can't really point to just one thing. There's so many things that's made it popular, and I'm trying to hit the high points. And so those things overlap a lot, too. So I hope that explains it without being too wordy.
Bloody Nora. Aziz, your answer was as long as an episode of Game of Thrones. You obviously do this thing for a living. How the hell have you fallen into making a living out of talking about this show?
Well, it's definitely something that I didn't aim to do. It got started as just something for fun. A friend of a friend was starting a Game of Thrones podcast, and I was very obsessed with the books and was excited that the show is making the books a lot more popular. And so I got involved, and we made a couple of episodes, mostly just talking. And over time, it really grew into something else. I started doing a lot more research ahead of episodes and writing outlines, and eventually that turned into writing full scripts. I now write 30 to 40 page scripts for each episode.
How?
Our episodes are usually an hour and a half to or more, usually closer to 2 hours. And so I usually turn around a 30 to 40 page script in about 4 to 5 weeks. It's pretty hard, but I've gotten better at it over time.
So tell me about your audience.
Okay.
So you've kind of given us a little bit of an idea about the audience for the show in and of itself. It's kind of old-time nerds, young-time nerds, people that like a bit of fantasy, and kind of an everyman feel now. I think just about everybody on planet Earth watches it. But who is listening to you pontificate about the show?
Good question. I think it's mostly people who are really into it, you know, people who are both are very deep in the fandom. They want more. Game of Thrones is, you know, so popular, and part of what makes it so popular is that people can spend a lot of time on it and not and always be talking about different things. It's got a lot of depth to it. There's a lot of different plots and characters and history and just, you know, talking about his writing style. There's so many different topics that people find interesting about it. Or you can just talk about TV show stuff like the actors or the sets or the costumes or the weaponry or anything like that. And
so is this really what you're saying is it's the nerd's nerd that listens to your show? But there's enough of them. Don't get me wrong. There's enough of them that you can.
Yes, that's very well put. Right, it's become huge. You know, like you said, it's so big, and that supports. You know, we don't. You know, I would say that we probably haven't even scratched. You know, we're probably not even. I doubt even 5% of the entire Game of Thrones fandom is aware that we exist. So I feel like there's plenty more growth potential too, because, you know, as you know, as a podcaster, a lot of people, podcasting's growing as an art, as a outlet, but it's still pretty new on the scene, you know, all things considered. There's still a lot of people that have never listened to a podcast, which kind of blows my mind, but that's where we're at.
All right. So let's go back
Sure.
A few steps. who wrote this book, and what is the general premise of the books?
Okay, so the author is George R.R. Martin, and he's a veteran author. He had written for Hollywood shows as well as, you know, being a published author before he went to Hollywood, and so he was had some experience writing for TV before his show was picked up. Of course, he's only written about 4 of the episodes for Game of Thrones. He certainly, his advice and his stories were a big part of, you know, being the showrunners talked to him quite a lot and got a lot from him. But as actual writing for TV, he does have experience with it, but he only did a little bit of it this time. Basically, I guess you could say that he grew up Roman Catholic, but is not that anymore. You know, he's one of those, someone that didn't follow along their parents' footsteps with their religious beliefs. And he's from New Jersey. He's grew up kind of poor, and he had a very active imagination, read a lot as a kid, and just wanted to write. Very early on in life, he was interested in writing and almost didn't make it, but kind of went for it, you know, kind of did that thing that a lot of, they say you kind of have to do. You really have to dedicate yourself to it and suffer a bit. And he did it. You know, he paid his dues and, you know, had to live really poor for a while, but he made it. And he wrote for TV, and he didn't really like Hollywood that much, but he wanted to go back to it. And Game of Thrones, apparently that was his path. He decided that epic fantasy was good, or could be good, after reading, I believe it was a series by Tad Williams that inspired him. It's called The Dragonbone Chair, Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn. And
yeah, what was the critical reception after he wrote the first books and they were published?
It was very, very strong, because it was some of the things I mentioned before about how it was adult and very character-based instead of fantasy-based. Mm. So he didn't rely on fantasy tropes. He, in fact, loves to shatter them. He loves to set expectations, because we're all used to seeing that we've seen certain storylines a million times over in books and TV and movies. And he loves to set people up going down that path and then take a left turn and say, no, this isn't where I was going. But he doesn't just do that exclusively, because if he was just to break every trope, well, that would be predictable too. So he does a lot of things that aren't expected, a lot of things that we've gotten used to, and he's kind of shaken us out of that sense of normalcy by doing things differently, having main characters die, having his beliefs on war being very present in the books, in that he thinks that war is awful and terrible, and that we shouldn't try to hide its ugly side. So he's very brutal in his depictions of war and the aftermath of war. He's gotten criticism for depictions of sexual violence, although I think the TV show deserves a lot more criticism for that, but that's a whole other subject. But his point of view is that this is realistic, and this is what happens in real war and medieval war, and he tries to be very realistic with his takes on these things, even though it's not a realistic setting. But he wants the characters to behave realistically, so by transposing real world human brutality into a fantasy set, he gets to show us, you know, he gets to communicate these ideas without having to, you know, touch on real people. And I think that's really powerful, because people love to quote Game of Thrones. I think that's something that's really interesting about it. There's a lot of its lexicon, a lot of the sayings that come from the books and the show are repeated in daily life. People have just started using them as, say, you know, like their own personal mottos, or I see it all the time, just people quoting Game of Thrones in daily life. And I think that's, I think that's a little off topic from your original question, but I think it's interesting nonetheless.
All right. So he's not only somebody with a vivid imagination. You said that he actually writes characters extremely well, whether they're women, whether they're children.
Yes, yeah.
I've never been particularly big into swords and fantasy, which people find somewhat surprising, considering I'm massive.
Oh yeah, I guess that is kind of surprising.
And I'm a big history nerd, but there's something about dragons that has historically is kind of put me
yeah.
off.
Well, I'll tell you, the dragons are not a very big part of the story.
Well, let me just expand on. Let me finish sure. where I was actually going to go with this. After watching the first episode, and we had those wolves yeah. wandering around, and then these kind of people with blue skin and glowing eyes. I remember back in, I think, 2011, 2012, when I first watched it, I went, I'm out of this, and I switched it off. It's only with the critical hubbub some 18 mm-hmm. months later that I revisited it and realized I'd made a massive mistake. Tell us where exactly Martin has drawn his inspiration historically. And I'll tell you the reason why I asked this question, because it took me a long time to realize that actually the world of Westeros and Essos in effect is, if I was a 14th or 15th century occupant of Europe, I would have believed that dragons existed. This yeah. is the medieval time. So we do have high skills in terms of metalworking. It's the start of the Renaissance. We have banking in Tuscany in Italy, which is in effect Braavos, etc. But I would have believed in magic, and I would have believed in dragons. And it took me, as I said, 2 or 3 years of watching it to realize, in effect, that's where he set it in the imagination of people of that time. But tell me some of the historical cues that I might have missed. Where has he drawn from real bits of history, which he's then transposed into his world and then maybe given it his own unique spin?
Okay, that's a great question. And he is very much a fan and student of history, though, like any of us, he has his particular interests and maybe some that he doesn't know quite as well. For example, he knows medieval period very well, and Game of Thrones. It's largely set in a medieval style setting. Obviously, it's also got magic and other stuff like that, but it's at its core very medieval. But he's got other cultures set in other places, like other continents, and those are a little less well done. They're a little more tropey, and it's clear that he's not as big a student of, I don't know, say, Middle Eastern history than he is of European history. But which isn't a criticism, but it's just, you know, or it isn't like a jab against him, more of just it is what it is. It's fair to say that he's stronger on things he knows better. I mean, that's true for everybody. And so he's very much written a lot about, there's a lot of the historical events in his series are very much drawn from history, especially European history, as I said. The basic conflict, the beginning of Game of Thrones, is between two houses, the Starks and the Lannisters, and that is very much taken from the Wars of the Roses, which is the Yorks and the Lancasters. And there's a lot of similarities in the characters there, too. We have Margaret d'Anjou of the Lancaster faction is very much like Cersei Lannister. Her son is a lot like, has some vague similarities to Joffrey. The Starks, their capital is, you know, York, and they're in the north, the northern faction. The Yorkists were the northern faction, and the Lancasters were more in the south, and that also matches Game of Thrones. Then you have England itself. England itself is Westeros, flipped 180 degrees, made huge. The Vale is Wales, for example. There's the Dornish Marches instead of the Welsh Marches, and there's Hadrian's Wall instead of the Wall. Right. These are all. And
wait a minute. I thought the Dornish Marches were the Cornish, was Cornwall, the Cornish lands.
Yeah, that's right. They would be there. They would be. Well, they wouldn't be Cornish. They would be. No, they would be the Welsh Marches. They would be north of, they'd be just like east of. I forget all those Welsh names. They're so cool and hard to say. Is it Powys? Is Powys the south there? I forget.
Powys is definitely in Wales. Anyway, you were marching through.
Forget my Welsh geography failure there. There's, for example, the concept of the Seven. That's his main religion in Westeros, and it's very, very much like Roman Catholicism, which he of course grew up with. And there's also Boy, there's so many. In fact, I recently did an episode with another history podcaster, Daniele Bolelli, on this very topic. We went through a lot of examples of where he borrowed from history. He borrows from the Mexica, also known as the Aztecs. The original race in his land of Westeros was a race called the Children of the Forest. And they're very much like Native Americans crossed with, well, Northern Native Americans crossed with Southern Native Americans, in that they use obsidian tools. They were very big into human sacrifice, and they didn't use metalworking. They had a closeness with nature, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of those things carry over. The Ironborn are a race that he has that live on islands, and they're very much like the Vikings, the Viking Age Norse and Danes and Swedes. So he very much likes to use real world stuff because, like I said, he's trying to make it realistic, and there's nothing better than the real world for realism. In fact, there's nothing else but the real world for realism. So it's sort of a shortcut to make sure that it's authentic, is to borrow from the real world. And then within that, his real creativity shines, as I've been saying, with the characters and the actual story.
Okay. All right. So we have this fantasy world which is grounded in real bits of history, which primarily focused on Western Europe, Western European historical lore.
Yeah.
Okay. And then out of that, then we spin this believable fantasy world. One of the things you said beforehand, which I found was very interesting, is that you said that he's really good at writing women. I'm really struck with how, from the original 2-3 seasons of the TV series, it was a little bit of a boobs and ass fest.
Yeah,
you know, don't get me wrong, it wasn't wall to wall, but I'd be lying if I said I didn't kind of look out for a little bit of naughtiness, and that was definitely a selling point of it. And I'm really struck by the time we get to season 7, there is less / none of that, but also that the female characters, in effect, are driving the whole thing, with the exception maybe of Jon Snow. It seems to me that it's all about sisters doing it for themselves. So can you maybe take us through the main female characters and maybe how they've developed throughout the series? And I think that's kind of one of the key reasons why, whether you're a man or whether you're a woman, this series is actually
okay.
So
great
compelling.
Question. Let's see how to approach it. There's a lot of things I can say about this. First of all, I want to reiterate that I think that most of the time, people write what they know what better than anything else. So of course, I think a man is going to write male characters better than he writes female characters, and vice versa. And I do think he's good at writing women, but that still comes with that caveat that he's not one, and that makes it harder. But I think he tried really hard to give it that appeal, and he tried really hard to show, and this is a reflection of history. History is written by the winners. That's an old cliche, right? But it's at least partially, if not mostly, true. But it's also true to say history is written by men, and that's not, you know, it's accurate to say that, but it's not fair to look at history entirely through a male lens, which is challenging because that's most of what we have. The sources are mostly masculine. So it's a weird challenge, but I think George has really touched on this a lot and shows that history omits a lot of powerful women. And there's people behind the scenes that, like, when you see someone like Alexander the Great or Julius Caesar or, I don't know, a lot of these powerful people, maybe modern presidents are more appropriate. Some of these like old school ancient kings maybe weren't answerable to anybody. But, you know, some of these modern politicians, they have a lot of people giving them advice and talking in their ear and pushing them this way or another. And I think that that's going to be the case throughout history. There's all sorts of world leaders had things going on behind the scenes, whether it was their spouse or their family, or maybe they had some hidden drug addiction or something like that, that really had a huge impact on history that we don't know. We can be sure that these things exist, but we don't know the specifics. So I think that's a big part of this, is that George is saying, hey, look, there were a lot of powerful women in history that didn't get written about because the men wrote the history and because they didn't properly understand how important, how big these influences were, like how important these decisions were. You know, we were finding out, just as a random American political example, we found out way past his presidency that Nancy Reagan had a much bigger role in Ronald Reagan's decision making than anyone had thought. And that's not necessarily a good or bad thing. It's just a thing. The point isn't whether her advice was good or bad. The point is that she had a big influence on him at all. And that's not something that anyone can quantify. We just know it happened. So I think that George is doing that a bit here with Game of Thrones and showing that a lot of these powerful women were not only written out of the history books, but they were maligned by the history books. There's like, if anyone who's read a lot of Roman history knows that there's this ridiculously often recurring trope of the wicked stepmother. It's just insane how often there's a mystery and a historical mystery that gets blamed on a woman. They're like, it must have been the woman. You know, that's so common, and it really needs to be pushed back against. So I think there's a lot of appeal because George is dealing with that. And he's also just on a more surface level. Yeah, there's a lot of, like you said, there's the women are becoming the queens and the rulers and driving the action for quite a lot of it. And that, you know, that stands out because, you know, just like history is mostly written by men, most TV shows are written by men, and the male characters are more believable than the female characters because they're written by men. You know, if you have a woman writing female characters, they're probably going to be more believable. And I think Game of Thrones, the TV show, suffers from that. They do not have a great mix in their writer's room of diversity, and I think that's a bit of a problem.
One thing they do have in their wheelhouse, though, is the ability to translate what's in the book on an epic scale. You know, a lot of money is being spent not only on the costumes, you kind of mentioned some way beforehand, but on the settings. And obviously, there is a lot of CGI,
yeah.
but it feels seamless. It doesn't feel like you're watching a whole load of watching visuals are being put together by computers.
Oh yeah,
and that's kind of underscored, pun intended, by the score, isn't it? So the way that the music is kind of used. Tell us a little bit about that and how some of these evocative music has actually made it onto screen.
That's a fantastic question. I'm really glad you asked it. Not only do I have a background in music myself, but I am just as of 2 days ago, I started discussing with a couple of people. And I'm going to a convention in Dallas a couple months from now called Con of Thrones, and I'm on a panel.
You do surprise me, please. You do surprise me. A guy like you will be going to a nerd convention, right? But as you were saying, go on.
Not only going to, but I'm one of the presenters. I'll be a panelist, and one of the panels I'm on is Sounds of Westeros, where we talk this specific topic about how the music in the show has added so much to it. And I have my degree is in classical guitar. So, of course, I have some thoughts on this. I think that it's amazing how much music in general adds to any TV or movie production. And I often want to tell people, just imagine those scenes without any music at all. For example, I just rewatched this certain important scene where a certain character's heritage is revealed. And there's a flashback where someone's dying. And it's a very emotional moment. And right at this key line that comes straight from the books, that's been something that some people who love the books as much as I do have been waiting to see on screen for literally 20 years. It was highly emotional. And at that point, it's this incredibly sad, sustained violin note that's just clearly designed to be as tear jerky as possible. And man, they're good at it.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Composer Rahman Djawadi, he's a graduate of Berklee College of Music, which is an amazing school. And he's also written the theme song to Westworld, which is another great piece of music. And he's written most of the music that comes in the show, as well as the theme song. And yeah, I couldn't say enough about it. I would just gush about it. It's really incredible. And there's a lot of depth to it. There's subtlety. There's certain characters that have music that applies only to them. This is done. You know, Star Wars does this. Luke has a song. Rey has a song. Things like that. And, you know, the Empire has its song, the Imperial March. And they do that to set the mood. You know, when you hear that song playing, that Star Wars Imperial March, when you hear that play, it's unmistakable. And part of it is the engineering of that song. It was so well written. The quality is a huge part of that. John Williams is an amazing composer. Rahman Djawadi is an amazing composer, but from a newer generation. He's young, and John Williams is in his 80s. And I just think that it's really hard to put into words how much it adds to it, but you can't say enough about it. It's just, it's a giant part of it. And it even affects non-humans. I've seen sounds, the way they impact us subconsciously is such a strange thing. At one point in the show, there's a scene where there's a baby crying, and the baby's cries are sustained for a while. We have cats, and two of our cats became very interested in that sound, and they were circling the TV, like searching for the source of this sound. Because they were concerned. It's like even the cats were concerned about this baby crying. And that's not even music, but it just shows you how deep that sounds can touch us, you know, because at a very basic human level, the sound of a baby crying is that has meaning. That touches us. It's like, especially a baby crying, not crying because he's upset, crying because he's scared. You know, that touches everyone, I think. You basically have to be a bit of a sociopath to not have that at least tickle your insides a little bit.
Oh no, we're obviously programmed, aren't we, to react to someone, to something that is defenseless, you know, in distress. And you can't be a human being, at least a functioning one, without having that reaction. Though I'm glad we've taken a significant turn down the music route right here, because when I was a hip, cool teenager, and things that were nerdy were incredibly unhip, i.e. Dungeons and Dragons, those kind of board games, and people reading fantasy books, they all seem to be into heavy rock and heavy metal. Two disparate things seem to overlap. Why is this? Why is it that people who have this fondness for this form of music, which as far as I'm concerned, right, and I say this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, has gone down a musical cul-de-sac so like this world of swords and magic and wizards?
Well, I would say, you know, I guess my experience hasn't quite been the same. I know a lot of people who aren't into that style of music at all, but it is very common. I'll definitely agree with that. I think maybe it's because popular music, mainstream music, is usually about emotions and feelings, maybe about relationships. The most common theme, like love stories, whereas metal songs typically are telling stories. So, and I think that's the appeal, mm-hmm. because, I mean, this is the appeal of fantasy in the first place, is stories. That's what people like. They like the stories. They like the escape into another world. And a lot of metal and heavy rock, that's what they're about. They're about telling stories. They're not writing lyrics about how someone made them feel or about their life experiences. They're telling stories. And I prefer that. I would much rather hear a story than to hear about someone's relationship problems, you know? that says nothing about the music behind it all. I'm just speaking about the lyrics, but yeah.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Let's put the lyrics to one side, because I am the type of person that actually doesn't listen to the lyric of any piece of music. More to the point, okay. I don't critically listen to it. Maybe that's more, you know. So you hear the refrain.
Yeah, hard
know,
not to hear the chorus.
And you
right,
go, yeah, yeah. You know, don't you want me, baby? Don't you want me, baby? You go, okay, yeah. But I'm not listening to the verses. So what is it about those thrashing guitars and those loud drums and this guy wailing on top of this dreadful music that so resonates with people that like a bit of sword and fantasy? Go on, tell me. Explain this to me, sir.
Okay, it's difficult for me to explain that. In terms of my own self, I can probably explain it better from my own point of view. I am also this as someone who grew up playing classical guitar. I'm also the son of a viola professor. My mother is the viola professor at Florida State. Mm-hmm. And so I grew up, and she had me very young. So she practices relentlessly. Now, classical music and heavy metal have a lot in common. Some people don't like to hear that, but it's true. of course, the sounds and the tones are very different, but the musically, as far as structurally, very similar. The styles of note usage and theory are have a lot in common. Also, the storytelling aspect. You don't see classical music pieces usually aren't written about someone's feelings about their lover. Sometimes they are, but it's your usually larger, grander topics or you know, like operas or whatever. It's epic kind of things. But I think it's also just, it's energy. You know, I grew up hearing drums and heavy music. Even my mother is a violist, but I still heard these. I glommed onto the minor key stuff. I like minor key music more than major key. I like sad music. I'm not sure why. Mm-hmm. But I also really like low sounds. I love bass. I love down-tuned guitars. You know, when I play guitar, I tune down.
Aziz, listen. I understand you know music inside out, right? Why is it, right, that these two genres have this massive crossing over point? Not on about you, right, and your musical history here, because you've nominated this week for us The Sword and Take the Black. Right, so that's when people go up to the wall, isn't it? You're banished to the wall.
Yes.
You take the black. And this is, for me, symptomatic of those classic nerds. Yeah. I'm not on about the new nerds, you know, the Johnny Come Latelys that are kind of now into the TV show. Mm-hmm. I wasn't aware of these books beforehand, okay. So I'm one of these new nerds, okay? And arguably, I'm a dilettante nerd because I don't know all the mythos behind Game of Thrones. You know, I'm mildly interested in it, but I don't know it. Okay. So, as we said, right, your podcast, you could argue that it's the nerds kind of podcast, but you are somewhat engaging and forceful advocate for the show, right? But I'm imagining there's a lot of people that read the books before there was a TV series, sat around in Iron Maiden t-shirts, thinking about, you know, Death Leopard, etc. And then when I listened to The Sword to Take the Black, you know, all of my prejudices are writ large. Okay. So let's have a quick listen to that and let's come back. Right, so explain what I just heard there, because what I heard was a whole load of guys, white guys with long hair, pretending it was the early 1980s.
Well, you're not wrong. That is, actually, they're pretending to cross between the 80s and the 60s. That the bands that the Sword most emulate are Metallica and Black Sabbath. So, and of course, Black Sabbath predates the 80s, you know, and of course, Metallica is very much 80s. So I would say that's a big part of it. But there's an evolution in metal music to move away from standard guitar tunings, to get lower, to you know, go from the standard guitar. Most guitars are tuned to E, and they have them all the way down at C. So a full two whole steps lower. And that's what Black Sabbath did. Black Sabbath was in C sharp standard, which is only a half step higher than the Sword. So, and that at the time was very new. It was very different sound. And interestingly, though it was very popular, it wasn't copied very much. Not a lot of other people did it. So I think that it was more of a, maybe a delay. It was a more of a, you know how a lot of trends are cyclical like that, music and trends and a lot of things kind of come back. These guys dressed like they were from the 70s in the early 2000s, and they were playing music from that was a cross between the 60s and the 80s. So they're very much throwbacks, but their sound is a little bit modified from, you know, where it's an extension of something that came earlier. As far as why it speaks to other geeks and nerds, that's tough. Besides the story thing, I don't really know. I'm kind of stumped. I just don't know. I think it's just, it might be just the camaraderie, like, you know, hey, that guy kind of looks like me, you know, long haired dude with an Iron Maiden shirt. Maybe that's part of the appeal. That doesn't explain why people like the music, but it does maybe explain how they decided to give it a try. In fact, I gave The Sword a try because of the title of that song. My friend was like, hey, I think this song is about Game of Thrones. And I'm like, oh, well, I better listen to that. And 2 years later, I befriended those guys. I hit them up. Said, hey, next time you guys are in town for a show, I want to meet you guys. And that happened. And that was in 2008. So every time I come to town, I get to hang out with them now. Yeah, I'm a groupie.
You're a Sword groupie. Listen, man, before you got into this whole world of the Game of Thrones, the Songs of Fire and Ice, what were you doing other than playing your classical?
Well, I got into the books in 2001. The first book came out in 1996. So I was, you know, a good 10 years before the TV show. And I was an IT consultant back then. I was traveling a lot.
All makes sense. All makes sense.
Right? Of course. Now. Poker player, guitarist, IT consultant. That all. It's all. Just a quick step.
Poker player?
Right. Yes.
Listen, I got fleeced. I got fleeced about 3 months ago. Some guy befriended me in a cafe. Says, do you want to come round to a man's evening? And I said, yes. New to America, needed to make friends, and I was fleeced. It was only a $20 steak, so don't get me wrong, right? But give me one tip as a novice poker player for me to not lose my shirt.
If you're a novice poker player, don't talk. Don't talk. Just keep quiet. People will try to... You know when you see poker on TV or you see people playing around, maybe you see people in a home game, when people are trying to get other people to talk, they ask them really mundane questions. They just want to hear what you say. They don't care what the words are. They want to hear how you say it. They're trying to read your body language. So you want to not give them that.
So it could be a question like, who is your favorite character on Game of Thrones? That type of thing.
Because they're going to judge how you answer, like how loose you are when you answer, how talkative you are. It's a standard... You know, you've heard the term tell. Being talkative is a sign of bluffing. Being quiet is a sign of not bluffing. So, of being serious. Because you don't want to... The psychology behind that is a person who, when you want someone to put their money in, because you have a big hand and are hoping that they fall for it, you don't want to give them any... Subconsciously, you don't want to give them any hint. So you people tend to just shut down. But when you're trying to fool someone, you tend to try to sell them on it. And that's just human nature. That's not nearly everybody works this way, but it's very common. And I'll give you a second one that's even easier to detect. People who put their hand over their mouth. If you put your hand over your mouth, that is a very, very standard human tell for dishonesty. Putting your hand over your mouth. So if someone's putting their hand over the mouth, strongly consider that they're bluffing. It's when they're especially if they say something, then cover their mouth. especially if they're hands over their mouth while they're pushing their chips in. That's a big one.
You mentioned this before, and it's like a theme for me, which is kind of just reoccurred in my head because of what you just said there, but about kind of misdirection. And one of the things which I've absolutely enjoyed about Game of Thrones is the apparent misdirection. So you've got the supposed union of the Starks and the Freys, and then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you've got this bloodbath. And I remember my jaw dropping. I didn't know what the hell I was watching. And then, and it just felt like it is incredibly random. But it's the multi-layered nature of the storytelling and the in-depthness of the storytelling. Yeah. That when you go and watch it the second and the third time, you see all the clues,
yes,
don't you?
Yes, quite a few. And in fact, he does that on purpose. The showrunners do it to a lesser degree, but George R. R. Martin regularly in his books gives you the answer to a mystery before he even lets you know that there is a mystery. So he designed the book to be read more than once. And that is, I've read them more times than I can count, and I'm still finding new things, you know, 20 years later. So that shows that, which is part of the reason I can do this for a living, is that, that we just keep finding new things. The depth is there. Our fans know that the depth is there, and they know that there's, you know, so much to find, so much to talk about. And of course, whenever we get new material, whenever a new book comes out, it's going to be gangbusters. It'll be the number one bestseller overnight. And
but Aziz, you don't need the final book, do you? Because you know exactly how it's all going to end because you've read this thing intently numerous times. You've worked out all the clues. So tell us, right? Are Khaleesi and Jon going to get it on, even though they're what, aunt and nephew?
Yeah, I think what's so funny about this is that they're such beautiful people in real life, you know, very attractive people. And you hear them interviewed about it, and they're like, they both visibly get shaken. They're like, "Ooh, it's so gross." You know, he's my cousin, or he's my aunt, you know, or she's my aunt, and you know, so they're like, "Have you guys seen each other? How are you grossed out about these scenes together?" So, but yeah, it's weird because that's such a creepy concept in general, incest, and there's plenty of it in A Game of Thrones. All these royal dynasties throughout history are very incestuous. There's cousin marriages all over the place. And they're not brother and sister marriages. Well, there are in some cases, like, say, the Ptolemies and other examples. But so that does even that does happen. But there's so many cousin marriages and all that stuff. Sure, I've completely lost the thread here. I started talking about incest and it just...
Well, that's what talking about incest will do. Right? So the question is, just as we wrap up, you've read these books over and over. And you've now spotted the clues that Martin puts in his books, in his stories, to reveal mysteries, to give us the answer for mysteries before he's even told us that there is a mystery, right? So what all of us want to know is, A, which is the reason why you're talking about incest and the Ptolemies, right? A, are the aunt and the nephew going to get it on? B, what's going to happen to the Iron Throne? Because my brother, who's a somewhat of a student of this, has a theory. And his theory goes like this, is that actually, because the Iron Throne is made up of Valyrian steel, and then all the White Walkers are coming over the wall here into Westeros, that symbolically, the Iron Throne is going to have to be denuded of its Valyrian steel. Because that's the one thing that can kill them. So there's going to be, in effect, a republic.
No, hang on. Okay. Let's back up. It's not Valyrian steel, the Iron Throne. It's regular steel.
So my brother's wrong.
It's just regular steel. It was melted by a dragon. The throne was forged by dragon fire, but it's just regular steel. Basically, all the people he defeated when conquering Westeros, he took all the swords and melted it to make a throne. It's very symbolic of his defeated enemies. But
that's a very neat and symbolic way, isn't it?
Yeah, if right.
Because it's a Game of Thrones. Everyone's fighting to be on the throne. You know, if we can take, you know, we strip it of its swords, the thing which physically makes it, defeat the enemy, there is no throne, and the houses are vanquished. The houses are liquidated. Yeah. It's a republic. It's the people. Isn't it Lord Varys that basically says he serves yes. the state and nobody that sits yes. on it? There you go. And then he becomes the president or the first consul of the Kingdom of Westeros. I think that'd be a perfect end.
I think that's actually a fairly well-regarded theory that there won't be an Iron Throne.
Oh,
the Iron Throne won't be there at the end, that they'll have a new system of government. Something else will happen. So yeah, you've kind of, that's a good catch, because I think that's, I'm a believer in that as well. I think that I have people ask me, who's going to sit on the Iron Throne at the end? That's a real common question we get. And I have a guess for that, but I also have but my main guess is that no one will. But I also have a caveat. Well, if I'm wrong, then I think it'll blankety blank. You know, that's kind of how those conversations go. But yeah, I don't think that, I think that it's important to note that about the Iron Throne. You say it's a really neat way of making a symbol for conquest. It goes a little deeper than that, because the Iron Throne is forged from swords. It you can, just sitting on it, you can get cut. it's still sharp. And that's the Aegon the Conqueror who forged that throne. His words were, a king should not rest easily. He should never sit, should never be comfortable on the throne. And it's like, that's really clever. That's a really cool way. That's a really good, great metaphor. It's like, yeah, because kings who are too passive or too, who aren't ruling their kingdom, who aren't taking an active role in leading their kingdom, probably aren't very good king, And so I think that's pretty cool. I like that, the way he worked that in there.
Aziz, thank you for coming on to Friday to explain your passion for this cultural phenomenon. And also, you know what? I don't think you rest too easy on your laurels either, do you? So whether it's you're sitting on an Iron Throne, you're a podcaster who displays great passion for the subject of your podcast. Thanks for coming on, man.
All right. Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. It's a good show. I like ask a lot of good questions. Anytime I go off and speak for several minutes and kind of forget what the question was, I know it must have been a good question, because it got me to say so many different things.
Lion Babe is an American alternative R&B duo hailing from New York City. It consists of singer Gillian Hervey and producer Lewis Goodman. Treat Me Like Fire features a warm, constant, vinyl record crackle. It was released in 2012.
Ooh.
Give me feedback. If you want to email me and possibly even get on the show, you can do that by emailing me at royfield@gmail.com. You can find me on Twitter. I'm not great on the platform, but I am at Royfield on Twitter. And of course, you can go all the way over to Facebook and you can find Friday 15 there. Oh, one last thing. Be awesome if you could write us a little bit of a review on iTunes or on a podcatcher of your choice. See you all again in 7 days' time on another Friday.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary. Not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.